We are now recording, audio only.
Okay, so later tonight or early tomorrow morning, depending on when the files are available, the audio recording, the PDF version of the deck, and a copy of the chat window text will all be posted on the Q&A webpage. So if you go to the website, you can find all of those items. Okay, so first off, these Q&A sessions and the library presentations, which several members of the club have been giving as Zoom conferences fairly recently, have been really popular. The library hasn't taken up all of the sessions that we offered, so the board has a bright idea that maybe we should run some Zoom conferences on specific technical things, independent of the library, just through our own Zoom conference. And so we've come up with a list of topics that we think people will find useful and are interesting. We've posted a web page with those suggestions. And then at the bottom of the page, you'll find a link to a Google Forms poll where you can select the topics that you think are interesting, the day and the time that you prefer them to be shown, and you also have the option to suggest other topics that would be of particular interest to you. So the board is looking for your input on all of those things. So there's the link. If you go to the website, just opcug.ca, you'll find a brightly colored link and just on the left-hand side and the lower down on the screen, which will take you to the technical solutions webpage. Okay, so that's something to think about. And now we've got a couple of follow-ups, and the first one is relating to those 20,000 emails that were hanging around, and Chris has some input on that.
Yeah, I did a one-on-one connection to the person who was having this difficulty, and the first real problem that we ran into was it didn't seem to be all that stable, an internet connection, and there seemed to be some applications that were hanging some and things like that. And so the aim of it was really to clean up the email, but it took us a while to get to that. Go to the next slide. So the first thing I did was I was trying to figure out why there was problems with the internet connection, and in one case it seemed like things went away, and I was on the phone to the person because I was we were using Windows Quick Assist, and I said, well, a restart of the computer didn't seem to solve the problem, and it was basically there was no Wi-Fi connections available. And I said, well, if you can go to your router, and maybe we can reboot the router. And in the process of doing that, she discovered that the power cord wasn't firmly in the socket. And so I suspect that some of the problems she's been having with internet connectivity stability was that occasionally it was just losing the power on the router, and then all of a sudden it would come back and so forth. So that seemed to fix things up there. And then we did get into Outlook, and one of the problems with Outlook.com is being web-based, there's no easy way to save an entire email to another location on your computer, such as she wanted to save them to a flash drive so that no matter what happened on her computer, she would have access to these. And I don't know if anybody else knows of a way of saving an entire email plus attachments as a file from Outlook.com, please jump in. But I searched around a bunch and couldn't figure out a way to do it. It turned out that the biggest interest that she had was actually photos that were an attachment. And so that's not a problem. So I went through the process showing how to select the photo, download it, and then copy that off to the flash drive. And we're going to do another session where we'll go through it a couple more times so that she's more familiar with it or comfortable with the actual process and that she knows how to go about doing it. So beyond that, connection to do that. I will then do what I can to help out with actually cleaning up those 20,000 unread emails. And so it'd be doing things like sorting, filtering, and searching to hopefully bulk delete a whole bunch of ones that are not of interest. For example, if you had from CBC Mail, CBC News or something like that, you could very easily sort by the from, and you might be able to grab huge batches of them at once and delete them. So that's still to be followed up on more. I probably won't report back on that unless I run into something that is particularly interesting that we discover as we're doing that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. A couple of people are reporting intermittent audio cutouts. It's working fine for me, and it seems to be working fine for a number of other people.
Okay, so it's not my end.
Do anything about that. And just if you miss anything, check out the audio file, and hopefully that's going to be complete. Okay, I've got a little follow-up on the other issue that we talked about last week, which was these weird and wonderful folders that were hanging around on an external USB, which were supposedly, or thought that they might be something to do with Windows backup. And Jocelyn actually had one of the answers, but personally, I've never used Windows backup, so I thought I'd take a look and see if I could figure out anything about these folders. Well, it turns out, as we probably all know, Windows actually has two backup systems. And one is to save copies of files with file history, which Chris had talked about some time ago. And the other one is essentially a disk imager, backup as disk images and then restore, which harks back to Windows 7, but is part of the Windows 10 release. So sometimes a bit difficult to find, and I think I got there by putting backup in the search box, and then it took me to the control panel, and there I've got these create a system image and that kind of thing. So I tried creating a system image to see what was going to happen, and the first thing it wanted was a location. So I just plugged in my trusty external USB drive and used lots of free space on that. This isn't going to work for me. And the reason it's not going to work for me is because although Windows has found a couple of recovery type partitions, it's found the C drive. It's also found my dedicated data partition, which it thinks is drive D. But what it hasn't shown are the Linux partitions. I have two Linux partitions, the operating system and some swap space. And of course, Windows just ignores that. We're not going to play with that whatsoever. So it's going to make a disk image, but it's only going to make part of a disk image, which is, to me, is basically useless. Anyway. And if you're only running Windows, that's probably not a concern. And Jocelyn kind of had the answer last week that when you run Windows backup, it creates a folder, and here's my external USB drive, and it's created a folder called Windows Image Backup, which Jocelyn indicated would be the case. And if you look inside that folder, then there are other folders and files. First of all, there's a folder called Dell Inspiron, which is my laptop. And then underneath that, there's a folder called Backup with a date and a peculiar number. And inside that Backup folder, there's a whole raft of files. And interestingly, some of them have numbers, like alphanumeric strings, a bit like that weird and wonderful folder we were looking for. Except that this one has a bunch of alphanumeric characters and then a bunch of hyphens, and the folder name didn't have any hyphens. And also, the folder actually has a .vhdx extension. So that's a virtual hard drive file extension. And again, that folder that we were looking at on the other external drive didn't have any file extension. So I suspect that folder has nothing to do whatsoever with Windows Backup, and it's more likely to be Windows Update, an orphan folder from some kind of update process. And the other thing that is you can do is do a file history. So here we are in the file history, and we can click on this Run Now button, and off it will go. And this time it creates a folder, and this folder is called file history. So again, it's not anything to do with those folders we were looking at. The image backup is one, the file history is another, and so that doesn't really help our question of previously. But interestingly enough, by default, file history, it copies files from libraries, the desktop, contacts, and favorites. Those are all things which are in the user's subdirectory, and my user in particular. Interestingly, when you run it from the control panel, you can exclude the folder. You can exclude folders. So I could exclude something, but I don't seem to have the option to include anything, which is not very good if you want to back up other things, like on my data drive, for example. But if I manage to find this file history in settings, in the settings menu, then you notice that I do have the option in settings to add a folder. And then I can, when I press add a folder, it gives me a file explorer type window, and I can select the disk, or I can select whatever folders, whatever I want. Next thing that's interesting is if you make the backup and then you go and try and restore things. And you remember by default, it had libraries and desktop and that kind of stuff. And Chris had mentioned, I think, that Windows stores a whole raft of stuff in the user's directory, things that you would never think about. Now, I don't use things like documents and pictures and you know, those kind of things, which are really pointers to real folders inside the user's folder. But there's a whole raft of stuff here inside my user's folder, which has been backed up, which I actually didn't know anything about. I mean, there's a folder here called GIMP 2.8. I'm now running 2.10, so I don't know whether that's relevant anymore. And Ice Cream Screen Recorder was some kind of application I tried to capture videos of the screen at one point. Some VirtualBox stuff, which I had installed but have since deleted, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole raft of stuff in there which I didn't really know about. Here's some of the stuff that was backed up, and how do I go about retrieving some of this stuff? Well, if we look at this Word file here called chatlog, I could open that in Word. I can find that that's actually a chat from a kind of a video conferencing session with a friend of mine in some other program. I think it was GoToMeeting or something. So if I wanted to recover that, I'd actually go to this green button down here, and so I'd highlight the file, I hit the green button, and it basically, as it says, restores that file to its original location. So it's a bit like a recycle bin in that respect. So it stores stuff, it backs stuff up, and it restores stuff, and that's fine, but it doesn't do the kind of things that I want, and it also doesn't help us find those files and folders that were orphans on the other person's drive. Okay, and to follow up even further on this issue of external hard drives, the same question, Chris has some comments.
Yeah, this all stemmed out of that same problem of weird folders that were showing up, and nobody really knew what they were. They appeared to be empty, but it turned out they weren't. So I did a one-on-one with using QuickAssist from Windows, and the person had three external hard drives, two 4-terabyte drives that were basically full, and they couldn't figure out where all the space was being used, what it was being used for, and there were those weirdly named folders that appeared to be empty. There was another external hard drive that was attached to the system, which was basically being used to store images, photos from digital cameras. And so the person was unsure of their situation with regards to backup. They knew the importance of backup, and they had tried using Windows Backup, the Windows 7 version that is still sticking around in Windows 10, and they weren't sure what was really going on with that. They tried using the software that comes with Western Digital Drive, which one of the external drives was Western Digital Drive, and they weren't sure what was with that and how it was backing it up, where it was backing it up, and how, more importantly, they had never tried to actually do any recovery, and so they were unsure of the process of actually being able to recover. Keep in mind, we don't back up for backup's sake. We back up so that we can recover. So next slide. So the desired outcome of all this was to find out where all that space is being used, free up space, because it's ridiculous that 8 terabytes of space was being used up that the person had no idea what was going on. So the first thing I did was I downloaded TreeSize Free from Jam Software, and it's an excellent, excellent program, very, very fast, which allows you to check out where your files are being stored, what are your biggest directories, how many pictures you have. It allows you to slice and dice data a lot of different ways. I ran it as an administrator, and it's really important with this program in particular, I think, to run it as an administrator. It turns out that some of those folders that appeared to be empty weren't empty. It's just that the user didn't have direct rights to the files that were there. So running as an administrator, you end up seeing everything, and then found out what was in those folders, and it was a whole bunch of backups, either being done by Windows Backup or by the Western Digital software, and Windows Backup had been running daily for months and months and months and months, and the Western Digital had been run at least once with a full image. It appeared that maybe we were actually taking backups of backups. And so what we did is went in and stopped the Windows Backup from running. And so it won't be generating those files every day. And next slide. And so, we stopped the Windows Backup. We installed EaseUS to do backup free, which is a really nice imaging software. I've been using it for a number of years, but I did a review of 4 different programs. If you look on our website, you can find the link to that if you're interested, and each of them has its benefits and drawbacks as far as I was concerned. The benefits for EaseUS to do backup, for me, it was the best of the one, but for you, it may be something different. So I created 3 backup tasks. The main one, they had one of the external hard drives, the 4 terabyte ones, was a desktop model external drive. So we set that up to do a daily incremental backup of the entire hard drive. And we ran one full backup while I was connected and we were doing some other things. I set up 2 other manual tasks. Okay, so they're not scheduled. So the tasks that are in there, you can just run them anytime by going into the EaseUS to do backup and double-click the task and it'll run. And so one will do an entire backup of the internal hard drive, all the partitions on it, to the other 4-terabyte drive, which happens to be a portable external hard drive, which is kind of nice because then they can take that easily off-site for off-site storage of backup. Remember, my recommendation is always to have at least 3 copies of every important file. So you should have your working files on your computer, a local hard drive backup, which is that first one we did, and then one that'll be offsite. Then we create another task which will back up the entire other external hard drive that is used for photos and just copy that to that same portable external 4-terabyte hard drive. And then the next step, we didn't actually get around to this, the next step will be to create the emergency boot disk and test actually being able to do a file recovery by booting from that emergency boot disk and make sure that everything is working and the person knows how to do recovery should the need arise. So I think that was a success, a little bit more work to do, but overall we freed up, I think, something like about 7 terabytes of disk space, and we'll have her well on the way to having a good recoverable backup solution.
Great, well done then. Well done, Chris. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it was interesting. Okay.
And so Chris had a problem with Microsoft Office. I can't believe it.
I'm going to take over the screen share because I think with the build slides and that, it'll be a little bit easier if I do it. So go to QA. Okay, and now. Okay. So, yeah, I had a Microsoft Office problem. So this came about when I went to get a copy of the deck that Alan had prepared for one of the library sessions, and I downloaded it from his Dropbox, and then I double-clicked the file, and it came up with this error message. The application was unable to start correctly. And so I clicked OK, and then it came up with, it found a problem with the content. And if I trusted the source of the presentation, click repair. And, well, yeah, I trust them okay. So I clicked on repair, and it came up with this, and sorry, PowerPoint can't read. And this had me thinking that I've seen this problem before. And I delved into my memory a little bit more, and I recalled what was and what the solution was. So the solution as dictated by Microsoft when you run into a problem like this is that you go into File Explorer, go to the file in question, you right-click on it and select Properties, and that'll bring up your Properties dialog box. And on the General tab, you see down at the bottom it has Security. This file came from another computer and might be blocked to help protect this computer. And you have an option to unblock. Or if you don't want to do that, you can wait patiently for Microsoft to read my report in the Feedback Hub, because I did report this problem to Microsoft through Feedback Hub. Okay, so somehow that file got flagged as coming from the internet. Normally what happens is when you're in this situation is the file will open in PowerPoint. You'll get a banner across the top saying that this file came from another computer. It may contain dangerous content. It's opening in read-only mode. And it has a button there that allows you to say, yes, I trust that I want to go into edit mode. But it wasn't getting that far this time. So I figure, okay, somehow it's being flagged that it came from the internet. How is that happening? Was the file modified? No, I did a byte-for-byte comparison with the file that was unblocked with a file that I didn't go in and do unblock on. And so the file itself wasn't modified. So I figure, is there a file attribute in the file system? Something like that. Sort of like a read-only? No, wasn't that. And I did a little bit of research, and I came across this, and I thought this was kind of interesting. I had heard of them before, but I hadn't really done an awful lot of research onto them. Alternate data streams. It's a feature of the NTFS file system. And so all files contain what is known as the primary data stream. So it's just your regular file. All of the files that you've normally dealt with, that is the primary data stream. But it can also contain other data streams, also known as alternate data streams. They are not normally seen. When you do a directory listing, when you open a file, these other data streams are not normally seen. But they can contain anything, and they can be any size. You could have, a text file that is one sentence long and is maybe 200 bytes in size, and that's all you see. And you could have an alternate data stream that could have megabytes or gigabytes of data in it that you don't actually see. Some programs do understand the idea of alternate data streams and can either read or write to them. Two of them of note are Notepad and PowerPoint. PowerPoint, we already know, that's how it is determining that this file actually came from the internet. Notepad is another one that'll understand about it, and I'll come back to it in a bit. So you can download a program called Streams, written by Mark Rusinovich, who's the CTO of Azure at Microsoft. Brilliant guy. He was the first person to reverse engineer the NTFS file system before he worked for Microsoft. And he has a bunch of utilities that are really cool utilities, and one of them is Streams. And it can list or delete alternate data streams from files. And I have the link there where you can actually download it from. You can also just Google for Streams, sysinternals, it'll find it. Okay, so if I run it, it's a command line program, and if you run it with, I call it streams, and then the name of the file, makeblogopl.pptx, and it comes back with the following. It comes back with the file name itself, and if there is an alternate data stream, it actually lists what that alternate data stream is. In this case, it's called zone.identifier. Okay? So thinking about the fact that this file came from the internet, that's sort of an indicator that that's what it's about. What I can do, because Notepad understands alternate data streams, I can actually call Notepad with the file name, makeblogopl.pptx, colon, and then the alternate data stream, zone identifier, and it opens up that alternate data stream into Notepad. So if we look at the alternate data stream that was associated with this particular file, makeblogopl.pptx, and we look at it, we see zone transfer as a title sort of to it, and then we do see other things in there that look sort of interesting, refer URL, HTTPS, Dropbox.com. Well, that's where I downloaded it from. Alan had made the file available to me on his Dropbox. And then the host URL, HTTPS, that's the actual URL to that particular file on Dropbox. But in addition to that, we see zone ID equals 3. Okay. So I don't know what the heck zone ID equals 3 is, but it sort of sounds that, you know, maybe this is the internet zone. So I did some searching on that, and I discovered there's actually 5 zones that are available. Local computer, or my computer, local intranet zone, trusted site zone, internet zone, restricted site zone. You may recognize these as security zones in Internet Explorer, and that's actually where they originally came from. And sure enough, zone ID 3 says it's coming from the internet zone. So that's how that file was flagged as coming from the internet. It was actually an alternate data stream associated with the main file. So the problem with Office files, the relevance to me of this is that PowerPoint can read that alternate data stream that got created by my web browser when it saved that file on my local drive. Okay, so it can read that alternate data stream zone identifier. It can see that zone ID is 3, the file came from the internet. It should open the file in read-only mode. It should add an info bar to the top of the file saying that the file came from another computer, may be dangerous, and is being opened in read-only mode, and give you the button that allows you to edit the file. But instead, it came up with the error messages. So what to do? I'll report it to Feedback Hub. is the best thing, and I actually went back and I updated my report on Feedback Hub to make it clear that I now understood what the problem was. It was the alternate data stream, and that PowerPoint, for some reason, is now choking on that particular file. So my workarounds, I can use File Explorer properties to unblock it. I could actually use Notepad and edit the alternate data stream and save it back to the file, set it to either 0, 1, or 2, and that would work. And I tried it, and it actually does work if I added it to that. I could delete the alternate data stream using streams. To me, it's totally useless. It just is, any program can read it and see that the file came from the internet. Well, I don't care. Or I can wait for an update from Microsoft Office that fixes the problem properly. And I'm hoping that they broke it pretty recently, because I just ran into this very recently, and I've downloaded lots of files from the internet, and this is the first time in a long time that I had this. So hopefully they can fix it as promptly as they broke it. And that's it for that.
That's great detective work, Chris.
Opening the file in something like LibreOffice, because several years ago I had a problem with a number of corrupted Word files that wouldn't open in Word, but open perfectly well in the predecessor to LibreOffice, OpenOffice.
Yeah.
And it was noted at the time that OpenOffice could open all sorts of corrupted Microsoft Office files that Microsoft Office couldn't open.
Yeah. It's entirely possible that it could work. If it understands alternate data streams, it should read that and at least warn you that the file came from the internet, and you have to decide whether you want to trust it or not. And that's what Microsoft Office is supposed to do, is just warn you, but allow you to open the file, and then allow you to go in and edit mode if you actually trust the file. So I suspect that it would open fine in something like LibreOffice or any other program that understands it. It's just that they seem to have, Microsoft seems to have broken that you know, really badly. And it's all Office applications, Word documents will act the same way. And I actually ran into this first when I think it was board meeting minutes years and years ago that I was getting this problem. And I thought it was Google Drive that was actually corrupting the files. But it turns out it wasn't Google Office at all or Google Drive that was doing it. It was strictly that Microsoft had broken it. They fixed it, and then now they've rebroken it.
And opening it in LibreOffice isn't a great solution because it's not really 100% compatible with PowerPoint, and a lot of the slide won't actually display properly. You might open the file, but it won't be all that great. There's a comment in the chat, Chris, that Karen had the same problem recently with Excel. And you just want to go, I'll share my screen again, and we'll just go back to that fix with Windows Explorer.
Well, I can actually show it. So let me just do a because let me just see. Yeah, I've got a file that I can show it. So if I do a share file, share my screen, and then okay, let me get rid of that. Okay, actually, is this kind of tiny on your screens?
Yes.
I'm on such a huge resolution. Let me try. I'm going to try something. I'm going to stop share. I'm going to reshare just Windows Explorer. And let me bring this down to a more reasonable size. Is that more visible?
Yes, that's much better.
Okay. So let me go. I've got on my drive Z. Temp and blocking. Okay, so here is makeblogopl.pptx. If I right-click on it and I go to properties, you see this down at the bottom where it says security?
No, that pop-up just disappeared.
Yeah, okay, so, unfortunately, I'm going to have to... Yeah, I'll try sharing my whole desktop, but again, it's going to be, let me just try to set the scaling a little bit better very quickly. Display settings, scaling 300. Okay, let me try this once again if I can. Share screen. Okay, now. Okay, is that a reasonable size?
Yes.
Okay. We should be able to see the pop-up now. So if I go to properties, do you see the pop-up?
Yes.
Okay, good. So now when you go to the properties, now down at the bottom, we see that security, this file came from another computer, might be blocked to help protect this computer. So if I try to open this file directly by just double-clicking on it, PowerPoint will start to open, and we get that problem with it. Try repair, and it can't repair it. And so... if I go back into that dialog box and go properties and I say unblock and click on OK, and now if I double click that file, it'll open fine. And there's that file has been open.
Perfect.
So everybody okay with that? And I'll stop the share. Okay, Alan, you can take things back over. If anybody needs step-by-step on that, email me, and I can send it to you.
Okay, so we should be now on the next question slide,
yep.
Which is there any significant difference between AMD and Intel, i.e. chip CPUs, if you're not doing heavy-duty gaming or video editing? And the answer, as always, is it all depends. I think we all know that Intel and AMD are big competitors in the CPU market, and it's been a kind of a seesaw battle. It's a moving target, as the image is trying to indicate. sometimes Intel's ahead, sometimes AMD's ahead. And right now, we're in a situation where AMD have released this Ryzen chip, and Intel have released a new chip called Tiger Lake. And so the good, the bad, and the ugly is essentially, if you look on the web, there's all kinds of discussions and benchmarking of these different chips. Basically, the Intel, the Tiger Lake, has four cores. It's a quad-core computer, and it's hyper-threaded, so it's four cores and eight threads. Whereas the Ryzen is eight cores, which are all single-threaded. And if you remember from a while back, we were talking about hyper-threading, and we said that multiple cores was typically better than hyper-threading, which isn't necessarily the case, but in general. Intel's stuck really on a kind of a 10-nanometer platform, whereas Ryzen have got their 7-nanometer product line going. So that typically means that the Ryzen chips are going to run a bit cooler than the Intel ones. But Intel has also introduced some hardware-based things called SuperPin, which is some kind of field effect transistor. So they're using some special hardware that will give them decent performance. Basically, the Intel chips are running at higher clock speeds than the Ryzen, so you get better performance that way. But the Ryzen ones, AMD has always typically been lower cost, especially for these kind of mid-range chips that we're talking about. But AMD always used to have the benefit of onboard graphics, which were really quite good. Well, Intel has now upped their game with a thing called Iris Xe, which are a new form of onboard graphics, and what I read is that they're really quite good. However, as always, the choice of the CPU is going to be dependent on what use that you want to put the chip to. And Chris has some comments on those type of things.
Yeah, I mean, the processor itself, really the both Intel and AMD put out a range of processors. So you can find low performance and high performance processors in both lines, no problem. So when I'm looking for a computer, usually I really start with a short list of other things. So if I'm on a laptop I'm looking for, you know, I'm looking for 15-inch laptop or 12-inch or something like that. That's probably one of the things that is really going to be a defining factor that I'm going to end up with. I'll look at storage size and technology. Do I really want to pay a little bit extra and get SSD? How much disk space do I actually need? Because that's one of the things that can be a pain in the butt to actually upgrade on a computer. Not overly difficult, but, you know, sometimes it can be a bit of a pain. How much memory? And that often is a factor that you really can't change. You know, you get onto some laptops in particular, and you might not be able to up the memory. So you don't want to buy something with 8 gigs of RAM if you know that at some point you're going to want 12 or 16 or more. How many ports are on the computer? You know, that's actually pretty critical in terms of what you're going to be able to want to plug into it and things like that. Then usually I'll be keeping an eye on it, and I know some of the models that are sort of middling to top end, which is what I'm going to aim for. And so I know some of the models on that, but I don't know exact models. And so usually at that point, when I get down to a short list of maybe four or five or even a half dozen different computers that I'm considering, then I'll look at the processors and I'll actually do a Google search and I'll do an exact make and model of each of the processors and just say, you know, Intel Core i7-6400-B or whatever it is, and versus AMD Ryzen 5 or Ryzen 7 and the exact model number. And then you will find that people have benchmarked the two processors and compared them. And so you can see, oh, yeah, okay, this one's going to be 15% better overall, or this one's going to be 40% better overall. whatever. And you can decide at that point which is going to be better. Personally, I don't care whether it's Intel or AMD. I want certain performance characteristics. And as I say, both Intel and AMD have processors that will run, you know, the range of processing power that I want. Don't look at a processor difference of 5% and make a buying decision based on that. If you end up with a processor performance difference that's running 30%, 50%, that's going to be noticeable. 10% change in performance of the processor, I don't think anybody will actually notice it. There's too many other factors that are going to be coming into play in your computer. And that's personal opinion on my part, but I think you won't notice the difference on a 10% difference. 30%, 40% above that, yes, you will notice performance difference.
Yes, Bob Walker here. I'm the one that asked the question, and the reason I asked it is right now with COVID, there seems to be a shortage of laptops because a lot of people have to work from home or kids have to do their school remotely and all that. So I came across a deal on two identical HP laptops for $1,100. I get the one with the AMD Ryzen processor and a 1 terabyte solid state drive. And for $250 more, I get the one with the Intel processor and a 512 gigabyte solid state drive. And it sort of struck me that, you know, is there enough advantage to having the Intel processor to get a half the size of a solid-state drive to make it worth the extra money? And
the one thing,
the $1,100 one comes with a USB-C, USB hub, and a stylus.
Yeah. One thing I would watch for on that is low-end processors, because if it's a Ryzen 3, it might be a pretty pokey computer. If it's an Intel Core i3, it might be pokey. Just as a general rule, I like to start at a Core i5. Generation of the Core processor can make a difference as well, but not anywhere near as much as jumping from like Core i3 to Core i5 will be significantly different. Going on the Ryzen side, I think there is a Ryzen 3, and I don't know the model numbers on that as well, but yeah, I know on the low end you can end up with some pretty pokey processors. So that's what I would do, is I would look at the exact processor, make a model, and I would do a versus on a Google search, and you will find that there will be a performance comparison between those two processors. 99% guaranteed you'll find an exact comparison.
Yeah, because this is for a laptop that I do probably 90% of my computing on, but most of that is word processing, web surfing, downloads, that sort of thing. If I want to do any serious video editing or gaming, I've got my desktop, which is a fairly hot machine. So I'm not really seriously concerned about the performance, but I'll have a look at the specs of the two chips and see if there's any real difference.
Yeah, it sounds though that the other differences between the two computers, you're almost certainly going to be better off going with the one with the Ryzen, because it sounds like everything else about the computer is so much better.
Yeah, the cheap deal with the Ryzen is from Costco, and they actually double the warranty period as well.
Oh, that's handy. Yeah, so my final slide on this, I threw in this thought that if you don't think you need heavy-duty gaming or video editing, that's not necessarily a reason to forego a decent processor. It no matter what you do on your computer, a faster processor will get things done quicker, and a fast CPU is not a bad thing. However, you do pay a little bit more for getting more performance on the CPU, sometimes a lot more, to get more performance on the CPU. But if you can get a high-end processor at a relatively good price, there's no reason to avoid it. If you have multiple computers and you have some other computer that you can always do for your high-end computing, than going with a lighter weight machine for some other stuff. Not a bad choice in a lot of cases.
Okay, and the next question is about KeePass, a password managing system that Chris was talking about earlier. That the program is showing a link to the latest version, 2.46, but it appears that you have to download the new version and install it rather than updating the one that you have. And that's certainly been my experience. You just download the package and install it. And do you recommend downloading the new version? Will it be seamless in terms of the database already created? Christopher.
Yep, definitely. KeePass is set up that by default they will check for updates every time it loads, and it'll tell you if an update is available. And there is a link that we'll just see, and see it in the bottom left, KeePass website. You click that, it'll take you to the website. You just click on the download link and then run the file when it gets downloaded, and I'm pretty sure it'll detect that you have it already installed, and it'll just update over the existing version, and everything will be fine. It's very quick, very easy, and it's highly recommended that you keep your software up to date. Not only can they add new features on it, fixing bugs and things like that, but some of those bugs might be security issues. And so you want to keep your software up to date as much as you can, at least from a vulnerability point of view. And so it's always a good idea to keep software up to date. I have never had any problem with KeePass in the past. I've probably done updates, I would guess at this point, probably about 50 times, and I've never had an issue with an upgrade.
And by seamless, it means that the new version essentially remembers the last database that you used. So if you have a KeePass database, and that's the one you always use, when you make the update, next time you run the program, it opens that exact same database file. So it is completely seamless. Okay, a question about Roger's Ignite Internet. The questioner wants to set up an Ethernet connection to the router, but there's lots of different Cat 5, 6, RJ45 cables, flat or round connectors. She's using Internet 150U with an Ignite Wi-Fi gateway. What sort of cable do I need? Now, we know somebody who just changed to Roger, so he probably knows the answer to this.
Yes, indeed. I have that exact internet router, the Ignite, Roger's Ignite Wi-Fi gateway. Uses standard RJ45 plug, which most networking is that. If it's not using something a little bit more esoteric like a USB Type-C or something like that, it'll be an RJ45. So it looks like a telephone jack, only it's a little bit wider, has more wires in it. Almost all cables that you buy nowadays are going to be Cat6, but if you happen to have a Cat5 or Cat5e cable lying around, it probably would be just fine. As you go up the standard, I read a little bit on it, but basically it comes down to it's shielded better, signal tends to degrade less. But like Cat5 cables can be good up to, I think, 300 feet or something like that. So as I say, if you're buying new, I would just go ahead and get a Cat6. But if Cat5 is available really cheap or you have one lying around, you should have no problem at all with that. In terms of where you can get cables, I find one of the cheapest places to get cables is Factory Direct. They have some really inexpensive cables. You can get inexpensive cables on Amazon. If you go to Best Buy, you'll find that their cables are really expensive. Another place that's not bad is Canada Computers. They have reasonably priced cables.
And you can check those things out on the web, too.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. Chris spent some time at the Sierra AGM and listened to a guy.
Yeah, we because we have a .ca domain name, we're automatically members of Sierra, or we're allowed to become members, and it just required saying Yes, I want to be a member because we already have a .ca domain name. And so when I got the invite to the AGM, I decided to attend it. And it was actually very interesting. And Bruce Schneier, who is a guru in terms of internet security, IT security in particular, he was doing a keynote speech at it. And he's brilliant. He's I've read a couple of his books. And I read his blog on an ongoing basis or frequent basis. And so he gave a talk, and it was some of the things that he had to say about the current state of affairs. Software is poorly written. The internet was never designed with security in mind, and that's we're living with that in, you know, to this day. The protocols themselves in the early days of the internet had no security built into them at all, and we're still living with that. An interesting comment he made was a defender has to protect your entire attack surface. So every input into your computer, every software that's on your computer, anything that can be attacked, you have to protect. The attacker only has to find one vulnerability. So it's a much harder job to defend than it is to attack. And an interesting one was we have to find a way to live in a dirty network. And he says that even though, you know, we can improve the security through, you know, updated devices or newer software and things like that, we have to live with those old insecure devices, old insecure software we'll be living with for years and years and years. So we have to find a way, you know, to defend in that dirty network, even though portions of it might be getting an awful lot better.
And there's a lot more that Chris had noted as being of interest. If you check out the OPCUG member forum for club members, and you'll find his post, which has all the relevant details.
Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff that was said at the meeting. I highly encourage people to check out the posting that I did in the member forum.
But Stuart found one thing that was very interesting. So he asked a question, and how do I protect my new smart fridge?
That was one of the questions that was actually asked of, I guess it was the panel discussion at that point. So Bruce Schneier hung around for the panel discussion. There were four other people from CIRA there as well. And somebody asked, how do I protect my new smart fridge? And Bruce's opinion was that, well, don't connect it to the internet. And that's the way that you protect it. And he says, well, you know, the problem is that some devices, new smart fridge is probably not going to be in this category, but some devices either demand that they be connected to the internet or they're severely limited in what they can do if you don't connect them. And so, you know, so it's really a difficult situation that you're in. There's no real good solution for it. He said, well, maybe something at the router, and he just left it at that. So, you know, I think what he was alluding to is that you might at the router be able to prevent inbound traffic. Inbound traffic to your device is probably pretty easy. For your device to connect out to the internet, maybe you want to restrict it so that it can't get out, or it can only get out to certain IP addresses or something like that. The router is a way to mitigate your traffic going in and out of your network, so maybe something can be done there. But he, quite frankly, said that, yeah, this is a real problem with this sort of Internet of Things where you don't really understand what's going on. The manufacturer may not have had security in mind when they actually built this particular device. And if you have a baby monitor that is allowing your video stream to be viewed by anybody on the internet, you probably don't know about it until you hear about it being reported in the news. What can you do about things like that? It's very, very difficult. One of the other commentators said that there's some projections, and I don't think they gave a year about when we'll expect it, but it was near future where they expect 1 trillion devices, Internet of Things devices, will be connected to the internet. 1 trillion devices. How do you deal with that many devices that need to be updated if there's a security vulnerability, may need a credential change on it, things like that? How do you deal with 1 trillion devices? Interesting question. Nobody had a good answer.
Okay, so the floor is open. Anybody who has a good answer, Speak up now.
Bob Walker here. It boggles my mind that the original internet was the ARPANET, which was a national defense network in the United States. And the fact that they thought everybody that was on the network would be a trusted user boggles my mind. They didn't figure that a baddie could jack in and do all sorts of mischief and everything. And the ARPANET was developed at a time when we already had Star Wars, and we saw R2-D2 jacking into the network and doing all sorts of bad things. Bad things according to the bad guys. So why they didn't build some sort of layer of security in originally is just, crazy. But the flip side is we might have a trillion devices on the Internet of Things, but I don't really care if some baddie goes and turns my outside lights on and off, on and off, on and off on me. So how many of these devices are really a security threat to you versus just a minor annoyance of somebody, is somebody going to go to all the trouble to hack in and turn my fridge off?
Well, if your thermostat gets turned down to it turned off in the middle of January, you might care.
Yeah, but is some hacker going to go to the trouble to do that when they can go in and hack into something and do some ransomware or other things? If somebody has the skills to break into these things, why wouldn't they go for something big? Like that's one of the issues is if you're a small fish on the internet, why is somebody going to bother with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain thing to be said for that for sure. But regardless, I mean, you get people who just do want to cause mayhem. And so if you have somebody who decides that, I've discovered this way I can do a spray attack where I can hit every person on the internet who has a thermostat Nest model, and I can turn off their thermostat. You may find somebody decide, I'm going to do it just because I can. So I'm concerned about the idea of internet-connected devices and things like that. Mostly what I have connected are lights. So, yeah, I'm like you. If somebody turns my lights on or off, do I really care? Probably not. Am I going to connect up my front door lock to the internet? Probably not, at least not in the way things are right now. And so an interesting side note to this, too, is that a lot of companies, including companies like Microsoft, are coming out with zero trust models. And so basically the idea behind this is that you do not trust any device that is on your network. And you do a specific authentication on every device that you need to be able to communicate with, and you limit the ability of devices to communicate with each other to only those permissions that need to happen in order for you to do your business. So if you're interested in reading up on that, zero trust model for security is something that may become more and more important.
And I think that's true, because the other problem with things like this Internet of Things is that potentially people could use them as a backdoor to get into other parts of your network.
That's right. As they get more and more sophisticated, that's right.
Yeah, and Natalie is saying that there are other issues like personal things, domestic abuse, and other things that can be hacked, stalking, etc. So there's a whole raft of issues that kind of have to be addressed.
If I could hack in and turn off my neighbor's very, very noisy pool pump, I'd do it.
I posted something about a year and a half ago about a kid whose parents had taken their cell phone away for a certain amount of time, but had managed to continue posting on Twitter using the smart fridge.
There you go.
So that's an example.
Yeah, they're incredibly sophisticated devices. Well, we saw last month this month at the general meeting about, you get Raspberry Pi devices. They're super cheap and extremely powerful devices. Well, these are the sort of capabilities that are being built into, devices like fridges and microwave ovens and all kinds of things like that. Just as we're wrapping up, we are at 8:30. There was a question from Karen. Has there been any past discussion about the COVID app? Download, don't download. Have there been past discussions about the darknet? The darknet is just, I think that would be a big discussion to itself. We haven't discussed it in the past. COVID app, we do have Bob Harris says he's proudly using the COVID app. I feel we should all install it. I know Linda is using the COVID app. Certainly the more people that use it, the more likely it is that it's going to prove to be at all useful. I have not heard any issues from either privacy people or security people that talked about the COVID app being a bad thing for any reason at all. It does insist that your Bluetooth is turned on. So if you don't have your Bluetooth turned on normally, it will impact the battery life of your device to some extent. But I think that's the only reason I've heard for not having the COVID app on your mobile device.
And Jocelyn's making the point that the app was mentioned earlier, and the suggestion was that it was fine to install. It's unlikely to be a security problem.
Yeah.
That was a couple of weeks back. I forget exactly when, but again, if you check the postings on the Q&A page, you should be able to find the audio file that has that in it.
Yeah, this is Jocelyn. Just to something that you were talking about at the beginning about how to save an email and the attachment of it. I don't know about Outlook, but I found a way with Gmail. So if you're interested, it's not it's a little bit, it's a two-step process. You select the email, and from the three-dot menu, you can say forward the email as an attachment. When that opens, you can right-click on the attachment and do a save as to your hard drive.
Oh, interesting. Cool. Thanks, Charles. I'll take a look at Outlook.com to see if it can do the same thing. Interesting. I never would have thought of that one. Cool. Thank you.
Okay. We're over the magic time. Are we going to do a wrap-up?
I think so. There was one last question from Glenn. Could a hacker use your IoT device to attack your system? I think we alluded to that. Depending on the sophistication of that IoT device, I think definitely it is a possibility. So, and the problem with IoT devices is that you really don't know what's there. I've heard of street lamps that had webcams built into them, all kinds of functionality, definitely something like that, rather than just something that can either turn the light on or off, is going to be something that is more vulnerable, I guess, to being compromised. So it depends on the IoT device, and you probably have no way of knowing the sophistication of your particular IoT device, unfortunately. Okay.
So just a few notices before we go away. The next club meeting is on October the 14th, and we're going to talk about Android phones and tablets. We have a bit of a hiatus in the library, but the next Tech Cafe session we're going to be putting on, the user group, is by Lawrence on scam avoidance and trust, and that's on November 23rd. And all you people on the dark side, if you have Apple computers, the library is doing a month of Apple software from BindMug or somebody right now. And then finally, next week we'll have a Q&A again, Wednesday, September 30th. Have any questions or topics that you want to share, send them along to our suggestion box. And that's it for me.
Thanks, all folks. So there's a note from Joss to everybody. We have a meetup group. If you check in the chat, there's a link to it. And he has a question. Did anybody show up here on the chat tonight because of meetup? Please let us know either by unmuting yourself or answering yes in the chat. It just went up today live, apparently, so I'm not surprised if we have nobody here from the meetup. But we'll keep monitoring and asking about that. If it turns out that we're getting new people coming in because of that, we'll keep it going. If nobody is showing up because of it, we will probably drop it.
I think all the names I recognize as being previous participants.
Yeah.
So
okay.
We may not have got anybody from Meetup yet.
Okay.
Anyway, thanks very much, everyone. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks.
Thanks much. Good job. Great evening.